revenue for Monday, March 26, 2007 will come to order. We have a public hearing scheduled on House Bill 3262, and at 2 o'clock we have an information meeting on the highway cost allocation study. So we'll begin with the public hearing on, and we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3262.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3262 authorizes local government to invest additional funds from the local government investment pool into somehow it looks like a segregated fund where they could go with a higher level of investment for those funds that are not necessarily immediately required for liquidity. And the genesis of this bill is probably will be presented to you with the, from the local governments. But if you see, there are a lot of citations in the law or in the bill to different other ORS citations and so on. So for the lawyers in the committee who always jump to the statutes book to get all the other ones, I put all the statutes that need to be known about this in the background material. So you would see with that where that investment can happen and how, who decides, what is the role of the investment council, what is the role of the local government and the board, the governing board, and so on. The most noteworthy point is the $30 million cap limit that today exists in statutes about the amounts to be left in the short-term investment pool. This $30 million, we have to know that it's a 1995 CPI index $30 million, which means by today's CPI index, it's about 30. It's an interesting number, 39.39. That's it happens once every 65 years that you get those numbers, Mr. Chair.
Or 39.39,
that's the case may be. Right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Just a brief question for Mazin. Mazin, the kinds of things that the local pool presently has, the market has changed considerably with regard to all of these kinds of things. Aren't these all, it talks about short-term, mid-term, long-term investments, aren't these all traded on a daily basis? I can go out and buy and or sell a three-year treasury bill today, this afternoon. These are all on the secondary market. Is there some preclusion by saying that, wait a minute, because there's a 39.39 limit on the certain amount of these, that local governments, if they could enhance their return, and if they needed to invest in 3 year, but if they needed to actually cash it in 27 months, the markets dictate that they could do that. Is that how does that play into? I guess what I'm after, Mr. Chair, is just a brief explanation of the change of the markets since the original legislation was passed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I thought you would never ask this question, but since you did, you're familiar with the fact of the inverted yield curve these days,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And the inverted yield curve...
Law of intersecting lines that you love so much.
Oh, yeah. Man, just give me a minute.
He's just warming up.
No, you got to be careful. There's another economist who really makes it hot.
However, in the past, when we used to see an inverted yield curve, we used to immediately think, recession, recession. Everybody goes and starts running around. The sky is falling and everything is going with problems. However, these days, because of the change in the globalization picture of funds and the different amounts of rates that you find from one end of the globe to another, where you could swap these things so quickly, the inverting of the yield curve this time around did not really make any difference. Mm-hmm. So it is very germane to ask, well, we have this short term, and it was restricted in the past, not to exceed 3 years of investment, and then if you are more than 20 days in the short term pool, more than 30 million, you have to put them out. Maybe that was a lot more germane in the past than it is today. However, the liquidity factor still applies. There is a certain level of liquidity with the type of instrument that you still buy. And this liquidity factor is what I think most important in this picture, is whether you need those funds to be liquid immediately in order to pay whatever your expenses are that you need to use them for. And this allows for the longer term, if it is chosen to be a longer term investment, it gives them that option. Now, having that option does not mean necessarily that they would have to do it, but remember, if they don't have that option, they cannot do it otherwise. So it has to be explicitly said in the statutes for the treasurer that he can invest those funds in a longer-term type of investment. And typically, hopefully, things will go back to the point where longer-term investment pay a higher yield with time.
Mr. Chair, I am familiar with the concept liquidity, but again, because of the globalization, liquidity used to mean cash in the bank now, negotiable order withdrawal. Today, with globalization, I'd like to know, and perhaps that'll come in testimony, that truly liquidity in 7 days, you can make virtually anything liquid in 7 days anymore with the globalization. So perhaps, as I say, that will come out in testimony, but I'm looking at it and saying any of these folks that manage these funds that are worth their salt know what bills have to be paid in 7 days. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler. The it might be helpful as we look at this to look at the way in which these funds are invested now and contrast it with the proposals that we're going to be hearing from. Are you able to give us a short précis on how that's done now, or should we ask someone from the Treasurer's office to come and describe that at a later time?
Mr. Chair, probably the Treasurer would be a lot more conducive to this question than the mechanics of how they manage their funds.
Well, what I'd like to do, in order to get us a context for those of us who have not been on the committee before, or at least not this year, not in the most recent years, is to hear from the Office of the Treasury, and I see someone waving back in the back there, to give us a little bit of an understanding of what happens now and what it is that this is proposed to change. And I think that some of Representative Butler's questions you might answer as well.
Yes, I can fill in something there.
Thank you.
Also, for the record, Linda Haglund, Deputy State Treasurer. A pleasure to be here. Just for background, currently the Oregon Short-Term Fund, or the local government investment pool, which I believe is a part of the statute that you're looking at, is a money market account, so it is used for liquidity. It contains a constant $1 net asset value, so there's no risk to the investor from a loss of principal standpoint. So it's invested very short. Generally, it has like a 90-day average life to it. While the statute says that it can be invested out 3 years, because it is a liquid money market type fund, it's invested much more shortly. If I could follow up, though, on the question relative to the $30 million. Local governments are not required to invest in the local government investment pool or the Oregon Short-Term Fund. It is something that's optional for them. So it's a tool, an investment tool, that they can make use of for their short-term cash. So the limit of the $30 million or the $39.39 is just a maximum of amount of money that they can deposit into the local government investment pool.
Okay, that's helpful. Yes, and then Representative Butler asked some questions about whether these statutes might be, if I can paraphrase it, obsolete because so many instruments are available on the market to buy and sell on a daily basis, even though they may be long-term instruments themselves. I wonder if you have any comment about that issue, and whether the and I'm not certain I've got it correctly, or Senator Butler, but my sense of it was that you were asking about the different kinds of instruments and the different lengths of maturity and that sort of thing.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I am concerned about the inverted yield curve if we're in a 3-year paper and the money is needed in 20 days, that probably isn't the best place for your resources. But again, I have confidence in the Treasurer's office as well as our local folks that if they've got some short-term, mid-term, and long-term funds, that they will put those in the necessary accounts. My concern is that we really ought to have and the dialogue, I'm sure, will bring it out that we've got good money managers, and my hope is we'll be able to adjust and lift the levels.
And Mr. Chair, let me just expand on that a little bit. Again, we need to separate. A local government is responsible for the investment of the assets of that entity, and the investment officer at each local jurisdiction. The investment officer at that jurisdiction is responsible for making investment decisions, one of which might be the local government investment pool. And that is a pool that has next day liquidity. So it's a very liquid investment option for them. In addition to that, there's a number of different types of securities that they can elect to invest in that might have a little bit longer maturity. So I think there's a distinction of the statutes that you're looking at here, which are specific to the local government investment pool, which is like a money market account, which is one option for the local government. In addition to that, there's a number of others that they can be investing in, consistent with their own investment policies for that particular entity.
Thank you. Is that any questions?
Well,
yes, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, in view of that testimony, then can someone tell me what this particular bill adds to the mix?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I think what it adds to the mix, it gives them the option to decide to invest in a longer range securities if they choose to do that.
But inside this local...
No, this will be outside the short-term investment pool. This is in top, beyond, and in addition to...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, for being confused. But
that's,
I understand.
That's why we're having this conversation.
I understood that what she just said was they have the option to do that now, but not pooled, apparently.
Correct.
In other words, the local governments have the option now to invest in longer-term securities. And what this bill says that they can do it this way as well as other ways, I'm just not sure what this bill is getting them. I'm sorry.
Well, I think we're going to hear from a couple of witnesses who will be ready to tell us,
okay,
answer
hopefully,
exactly that
hopefully
question.
Hopefully this will make more
right.
sense to me.
So you have an idea of what you're going to be talking to. Thank you very much. We appreciate your coming forward extemporaneously like that. Morgan Cowling and Michelle Hawkins.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. Hopefully I can add some clarification about this bill and the intent of this bill, because I'm going to speak specifically to the goal of the bill, but not specifically to let me take another step. We need some amendments, and right now the bill as written does not achieve the goal, so I'm going to talk about it generally. And I've brought Michelle Hawkins, the Linn County Treasurer, to speak more eloquently than I can about the nuts and bolts of current county investing. So, and she has some remarks as well. First, the goal of this bill is to create
an...
For the record, I'm Morgan Cowling with the Association of Oregon Counties. I apologize. The goal of this bill is to establish an intermediate investment tool outside or through the Treasurer's Office outside of the current local government investment pool. So that local governments, cities, counties, and special districts could invest their non-dedicated or surplus money for set periods of time. And the intermediate investment pool would have an average maturity date of 18 months, and local governments would not necessarily have to commit their resources for that amount of time. They could do shorter or longer, but the average on this pool would be 18 months. This is an important option for counties right now because of the loss of the forest safety net. We know that a couple of counties have been able to put away some reserves in their county road departments for emergencies or capitals, and this would be an additional tool for those select counties to get some additional interest for them. It'll also help counties with limited resources. We think that it'll probably be the smaller or medium-sized county that will take advantage of this because they have limited staffing and resources for full-time portfolio management. So because they have so many competing duties as the county treasurer or finance officer, this would be one other additional tool in their tool belt to use for their surplus or reserve funds. This intermediate investment option would hopefully yield greater returns for the counties for two primary reasons. One, the commitment of resources for a set period of time, and two, the additional pooling aspect of this that they can do through the state treasurer's office. Right now, the current investment option that counties have through the state treasurer's office is the local government investment pool that we had been talking about earlier. This short-term option is primarily, or one of the goals of it is liquidity. The other two is preservation of principal and yield. So while it is an important option, we're trying to create another option through the state treasurer's office. I've spoken with several county treasurers to see if they would use this tool, and as good stewards of public funds and prudent investors, the use of this fund will depend on the interest rate that they can get and the other options available. A couple of counties I spoke with had this to say, and I'm going to quote, it's in the testimony that I provided as well, but Terry Morton, the treasury manager at Multnomah County, said this would be a great idea subject to the state treasurer's amendment. And Mike Long from Klamath County, the Klamath County treasurer, said this would be looked at as another county investment tool for Klamath County if this bill passed and became law. This is a new idea, and we're hopeful that this can provide counties, like I said, another tool in their toolbox for money management. We're still working with the state treasurer's office to come to some agreement on the amendments to achieve the mechanics of the bill, but that is a discussion that's ongoing right now. So I'd be happy to answer any questions at this time or turn it over to Michelle Hawkins to talk more generally about county investing. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Morgan?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Butler.
One of the things that confuses me a little bit about Morgan's testimony is, Morgan, you said the intermediate pool would be for 18 months for such things as road departments and other emergencies. Now, when we talk about emergencies, normally we don't talk about intermediate. Can you clarify that for me, please, for the record?
Sure. Chair Bernhardt, Representative Butler, I was making reference to county road departments have set aside some reserves for emergencies and for capital projects. I understand the question, how could you set aside this money in this investment pool and dedicate it for a set period of time if that money was for an emergency? That's why some of the reserves have been dedicated, but like I said, some of those are for capital as well, and that would be a discussion that the county treasurer would have to make sure that the money that's set aside for emergencies is not invested for a longer period of time.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. You said that the bill required amendment. It looks to me like it's got to be essentially rewritten because it doesn't look to me like this bill does anything even remotely like what you're talking about. Have I misunderstood it in some way, or am I right? It appears to me as though you need a whole new section on intermediate investment pool?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, the amendments that we're currently working on with the State Treasurer's Office do need to do two things. One, they need to allow the State Treasurer to invest the commingled accounts subject to other statutes. And two, they need to allow local governments to invest those monies on their behalf. So those are the mechanics generally that are needed.
In a new pool. Right.
That's what's
not in here, if I read it correctly. All right. Thank you. That does clear up a lot, because I think that may clear up some of what Representative Berger was worried about, too, because the measure doesn't seem to read like what you want at all. All right. So we're going to get amendments that you and the Treasurer will agree upon and bring to us.
Chair Barnhart, that's correct.
Thank you. Michelle.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and members of the House Revenue Committee. For the record, my name is Michelle Hawkins, and I am the Linn County Treasurer and Budget Officer for Linn County. I'm going to give you a little background on myself. I'm the past president of the Oregon Association of County Treasurers and Finance Officers, as well as their liaison to the Association of Oregon Counties, which then puts me on the Legislative Committee, on the Board, and on the Governance Committee. And then I'm also the Oregon Municipal Finance Officers Board of Directors and the Oregon Short-Term Fund Board of Directors. So that's just a little bit of background. I've been working with Morgan Cowling from the Association of Oregon Counties on House Bill 3262 to try and make it possible for small entities to make sound investments and earn greater return on their investments. Now, I'm going to give you a little background also of the difference of each county. Not all counties' treasurers are budget officers. There's actually only three or four of us. In my county, I work hand in hand with about 30 or 40 different school districts, water districts, all different kinds of districts. And with those districts, I get to talk about budgets and investments on a different level than most treasurers. I know that over a course of time that many of those districts have very little money. And if they do, they're building up a reserve. And so this kind of talk has actually happened over the course of the last year with many of those entities, which other treasurers have not had those discussions. So I actually had talked to the treasurers at our association meeting, which was just last month, and brought this concept to them. And every single one of them said, the concept is wonderful. Might not be for me, but it is for someone else out there. It might not be for county treasurers with a lot of money, but it definitely could be for county treasurers with a little bit of money, knowing that they have reserves that go forward from year to year. So I actually am going to quote one of the treasurers who emailed back to me, and this is Linda Pitzer from Lincoln County. Although Lincoln County's portfolio is small enough to conceivably be deposited into the LGIP in its entirety, I watch for outside investments that can give me a better return. It seems this would give us the option of depositing funds into this pool account at a competitive rate without going through the process of purchasing securities from either a bank or a broker. Now, there's lots of people that I work with that don't build a portfolio because, for one thing, they don't have the time or the energy to do it, so they literally will just put all of their money into the pool. This would give them that option to build that portfolio. Let's say right now the pool is at an average yield of just 5%. If I knew that I could go out for 6 months or 90 days or a year and knew that I could get 5.2%, and I'm going to take that hedge on that we're actually coming back down from a 5%. So now I'm going to make a yield greater than I would have had I just kept it in the average for over the course of that whole year. Now, I know back about 2 or 3 years ago, I was buying investments out at 7%. For 18 months, my portfolio was about 3% higher than what the LGIP pool rate average was. So I was making big bucks on where everybody else was in the pool. So this would actually give those smaller entities, even fire districts who know that they want to buy another fire truck a year from now and they're going to put a portion of that money away knowing that the rates might be coming down, you're going to have to take that, you know, under assumption as to the pool is probably going to come down just a little bit. I'm going to take that market and say, let's see if I can get a higher rate for 90 days. And so this just gives them that one more tool that they wouldn't have had they just kept it in the average. And so that's really where I'm after, is not necessarily for myself, but I know that a lot of these smaller districts would love to have a tool like this because they don't have the time to go out and build a portfolio. And I've been working on some on how to build a portfolio, because we do have new people coming into these finance positions that don't know what they're doing. And this would literally give them time spent with the Treasury to find out how to build a portfolio before they get good at then going out and finding themselves a broker and doing it otherwise. So I don't see this as something that's a necessity for everyone, but it is for the smaller districts, because this would be something that they could be taught. And I would love to be able to say, hey, look, it's still within the pool. You've still got a covering. You're still collateralized. Let's try this. Let's learn how to do it so then you can get comfortable with it and then be able to go out and do it on your own. So any questions?
Thank you very much. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure. Thank you, Linda. Thank you, or rather, Michelle and Morgan, for your and Emma, for your testimony today. I just want to make sure that we get on the public record that if you develop an intermediate pool for 18 months, and let's say that the road district says, hey, we need a patrol and we need a 10-yard and we need some other kinds of equipment down the road, we think that'll be 18 months to 2 years, and we'd like to go ahead and stick that in there. Then I have an emergency. We have a total road wiped out and a flood that's involved. And during that time, interest rates have materially increased, such that the inverted rate that the inverted yield curve that we're talking about now has made that 18-month investment worth less in principal than what it previously had been. But that local government needs that money today, a month after it stuck it into an 18-month account. Please let me know on the record that you recognize that it could be that they will have invested $5 million in there and may be only able to withdraw $4.7, $4.8 million. Do you understand that?
Yes, I do.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Buffett, although the yield curve is inverted, does not mean they would be losing money. It means they would be gaining less interest in the long term than they would be gaining interest in the short term. So instead of gaining 5.5, they'll be gaining 4.85. That's because it's an interest. It's not going down. If the interest is in the negative territory, then we're probably a lot more problems than than this.
Well, I think Representative Butler's point, if I can paraphrase it, is that
I'm not convinced.
Well, is that when interest, if you buy a security and interest rates go up, the value of that security today in the market is going to be smaller than its face value because it doesn't return as much interest as you can get with other instrumentalities in the market the same day. I think that's
exactly
essentially
what
he was talking about. And
that is a loss of principal, Mr. Chair.
Correct. It's a loss of principal. If you held it to maturity, you would get the interest that you'd bargained for plus your principal back. But if you have to sell it early, then you will only get the interest that you've paid for, but you have to discount based on the fact that the interest rates that are available in the marketplace are higher now. I think that's the essence of it, and that is a concern. If the liquidity in the account is such that the account's priced based on the need to sell in order to return funds to the investor. And you understand all of that, don't you?
Chair Barnhart, could I just address one more thing?
Please.
I know that most treasurers have a policy put into place, and we do within our policy state exactly what kind of liquidity we have to have, and it's done on a percentage basis. So this would still come under those policies, and I know as for myself in doing investments, I take into consideration a lot of things so that I know how much liquidity I should have, and I usually go above and beyond that so that I won't get stuck in a place like that. And I would say that the most investors do it that way, that they try not to ever get themselves backed into a corner that they would not be able to get out of. And so I think it's up to each person that's doing those financial looking out towards the future and saying, this is what I think the market may do. I may not decide to put $5 million. I may decide to put only $2 million and then take the other and leave it in the pool because I'm going to bank on it might be reversed. So those are all those questions that we have to ask ourselves as we're doing those investments out to 18 months. But I do know a lot of people that won't go out 18 months when there are those questions. They pull it in and they'll only do 90 days or they'll only do a year, but they won't go out 18 months. This still gives you that option to pull it back in and be a little bit tighter and be prudent with your money and not making a long-term investments because you're worried about that.
And, Mr. Chair, my concern there, and I express it on behalf of the of myself and the committee, is that you may not always have 36 fiscal officers with that kind of financial acumen.
That's certainly
correct.
An issue, isn't it? Another issue that occurs to me, are there other questions? Another issue that occurs to me as we're talking is that you're presupposing a relatively sophisticated fiscal officer in each county, and that is, of course, the issue that Representative Butler raised. Now the question becomes, with two different investment pools in the Treasurer's office, who's responsible for advising the investment officer or the fiscal officer on how to allocate funds to the two pools or to make other choices? At this point, I think those decisions are made entirely at the local level. And I think one of the questions for the Treasurer, who's here, is to decide whether that needs to be made explicit in the bill, if it is already explicit in the law, and whether we want to make any changes to that. That would be something I would leave to you as you're working on your amendment. But what is your understanding now about the place of their responsibility for making the decision, but also the place where advice comes from, if any?
Well, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, to be able for a county to invest in this intermediate investment pool, they must have an investment policy approved by the Board of Commissioners. And in the last version that I saw of the amendment, it was still subject to approval by the Short-Term Fund Board. So there were two places where people had to say what the county investment policy is and okay it. And Michelle can speak to what the Linn County investments policy is, but that's at least one place where the Board of Commissioners have input into where the investments for that county will go.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative Berger.
Well, I was just going to comment, Mr. Chair, that another question then that comes to mind is we have a new pool, a new set of sort of training pieces that go around the new pool, and is there consideration given to what that will mean inside the Treasurer's office in terms of personnel and any other considerations? Is this they just make up new pools willy-nilly, or is there going to be some consideration to what that will mean from them?
I'm assuming that when they get their amendment finished, they'll be able to tell us the answer.
That is to be hoped, and that's what I'm putting on the record.
Right. Thank you. I think that's a very good question. other questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair.
You're Representative Butler.
Nothing that I have said in question or comment form for the record today is in any way to try and discourage this from happening. I think this is an excellent opportunity for local governments to have a better pool in which to invest, and as long as they understand that there might be, however small it might be, that there might be some potential risk that they would that they would invest on a midterm pool, but need the money on a short term basis, I think that this gives, as has been mentioned, and I'm sorry to have to use a cliche, another tool for the tool belt to go ahead and allow these folks to do that, and I'm fully supportive of that concept. My concern is that AOC and other League of Oregon cities and other governmental and local districts all need to be at the table with the Treasurer's office on a regular basis so that you don't have a new kid to the block in Sherman County that comes in and says, what are we sitting on $5 million for? Let's put it in this midterm program out here, and then rates go haywire, and you're eventually able to
start drawing on that account within a few months at 95 cents on the dollar. And that's my biggest concern, is that we just make sure that this is the process of education continues on for all of these good people.
Thank you, Representative. And may I say, Ms. Hawkins, it is wonderful, and I'm very pleased to know that Linn County, which is one of the counties that part of my district is in, is having its funds handled by such a capable and well-qualified person. We appreciate your testimony today very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker.
And,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
May I brag about my county commissioner, too, as well?
Yes, certainly.
Or not county commissioner, but treasurer.
County treasurer.
Outstanding job doing there.
Yes.
Thank you.
All that we could all have every county so fortunate to have the caliber of leadership like that.
Thank you very much. We'll hear now from Andy Shaw. For the city's perspective, I suppose, huh?
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Andy Shaw at the League of Oregon Cities, just here to lend support to the bill. We think this, I hate to use that cliche, this gives us another tool in the toolbox. So we urge your support of the bill when it's amended. We are happy to work closely with the Treasurer's Office. And one good place that we can spread education about the risk that exists along with the potential benefit of this is through the Oregon Municipal Finance Officers Association, who the counties and the cities work very closely with. They have annual conferences and education about all these types of tools and the risks and the benefits they provide to cities and counties. Thank you.
You expect if this were available that cities would make use of it?
I do. We have, Chair Barnhart, we have a number of small cities that, for example, obtain a very small amount annually from the highway fund. And they can't, their annual allocation isn't enough to do one project. So they save that money for a few years. That would be one good example of a perfect time to save that money on a long-term basis for that pavement project that they're awaiting 18 months, 2 years out. So I think this could be a very valuable tool, especially for those small cities.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 3262? I think it's clear that we need to hold another hearing when the amendments are finished, maybe in conjunction with a work session. At this point, we're not certain. But with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3262. And we have a special order of business for 2 o'clock. But Mazin has indicated that he's prepared to talk about the issue in more general terms, and I think we should hear that now, and then we'll be prepared to open our information hearing at 2 o'clock for the report. Mazin? Oh, okay. We may be from that after. All right.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, listen. The soon by 2 o'clock, hopefully, if everything runs on time, we will receive a report of the highway cost allocation study. And towards the end of the meeting, you will receive another report or a study of the flat fee study. Now, one important thing is to have in the background while you're listening to the conclusions of this study is primarily why we're doing it and what needs to be done afterwards. I think there is a policy decision at the end that will be in your hands primarily as what to do with the results of the study. And this comes out of the constitutional dedication that you have in the constitutional requirement that is put in the legislature. Now, just to put in your material a little bit of background on what is the Oregon road use for taxes are and what is the constitutional dedication of what is the highway fund dedicated for. And just to mention that in around 1999, along with another referral to the voters, the Article 11.3A was added to the Oregon Constitution. And this basically requires the legislature for every session to look at the biennial review and look at the shares and proportionality of payments that you'll find in the page 2 of the material I've passed to you. And it requires that if there is a necessity to adjust any of these revenues, that these adjustments in order to preserve what is the heavy vehicle versus the light vehicle shares need to be adjusted towards. Now, that constitutional section also has an explanation, just like all constitutional paragraphs have in the statutes, the ORS 366-506. And it goes primarily and puts to a certain definition of who is required to do this. And it puts the requirement of the study, on the biennial study, on the Department of Administrative Services. So the Department of Administrative Services is the executive department, or the executive branch department that performs the study, and this was a change moving it from ODOT to the Department of Administrative Services. And the Department of Administrative Services either does it itself or contracts for the study. And this time, as the few other times that have been happening since 2001, they have a consultant who have performed that study for them. Also, the requirement, as you see in four, subsection 4, is to give a report to both legislative revenue committees and both committees from both chambers that go in transportation or specialize in transportation. So at the end of the day, you would either get a recommendation from the consultants that we will receive the study from, as whether the amounts of taxation, if you will, needs to be adjusted, and that is where the tax policy comes into issue. Whether this taxation levels have to be adjusted, rather than only the transportation policy section. Now, that's that's aside from whether the within classes, as you know, the heavy vehicles have within the heavy vehicle taxation a whole different level of taxes. Whether that needs to be adjusted, that is a policy decision that you might engage in, but it's not a constitutional requirement. So I just wanted to make a distinction between what you choose as a policy decision versus what is constitutionally required by you. And then that's for the highway cost allocation section of our program, I guess. The other one will be the flat fees. The flat fee is a payment that certain commodities and trucking concern of those commodities pay instead or in lieu of the weight mile tax. And the flat fees in principle are supposed to be revenue neutral. So the law puts in perspective as who decides and who studies whether their neutrality is a fact or not. And it is the Department of Transportation with the Commission. This is in ORS 825-482. And they need to have a recommendation to the Legislative Assembly for the adjustments of the flat fee, whether those flat fees need to go up or down, depending on which one of them. Typically, there has been a different payments and a different amounts between the different commodity payers. So you would find one overpaying, the other three underpaying, or a combination of all. latest study has indicated that there is a change that needs to be done, and there is a letter to the effect that says we need to adjust those. However, it seems like there are different ways of looking at it. You will hear from the Department of Transportation on this issue, and you'll be able to, at that time, entertain whether a decision, a policy decision, needs to be considered here of changing those or adjusting them or not. Now, this issue have been litigated in courts for a number of years, and there needs to be, I think, a clear legislative intent whether we are changing or leaving those rates where they are, in order to make it to make clear whether we are changing the policy or maintaining it as it is. So,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler,
could I just ask a mechanical question?
Sure.
Of Mazin at that point? Mazin, when we received the highway cost allocation study, and there is a recommendation therein by the director from the Department of Transportation for adjustments, it appears that some of the adjustments are as much as 35% increases. It's in the Constitution that they each have to pay their respective and proportionate share. Is it an automatic adjustment that is done administratively by the department, or is this something that requires legislation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, it requires legislation. You have to act on it legislatively in order to make that adjustment.
If I may, Mr. Chair,
my
concern, Mr. Chair, is that it is a constitutional requirement that each instrument that uses public highways pay its proportionate share, and I am concerned about while there are some decreases that may be requested and required in order to bring the equity that the Constitution demands for the utilization of those public roads and rights-of-way, my concern is that some of our colleagues may feel that this is somehow a tax increase. Is it, in fact, a tax increase that requires a three-fifths majority vote, or is this merely an adjustment of the existing rates?
Well, that's an interesting question, I think because of the definition of what it is, I think it would probably require a three-fifths vote. However, I think with prior discussions with the Legislative Council on the amounts and what is being done with the tax increase or not, I think the definition of what would be for the requirement, I would have to consider with this.
It's truly not intended to raise revenues. It merely aligns the revenues. Some are winners, some are losers. It is ultimately neutral with regard to it is neutral in the effect that if your utilization of the highway costs more to the maintenance, upkeep, and the long-term viability of the highway, then you will pay more. And so it really is, it really truly maintains the highways in their in a suitable fashion for their use. But I think that any bill that would be proposed would not be truly a revenue raising bill, even though it adjusts some rates. So I'm just concerned about how it will appear, because as I say, there's some winners and some losers in this process. Usually, I think if I recall the last few sessions, there's been just tiny, just infinitesimally small amounts which did not even require modification. This time it appears that a modification in some rather larger amount is maybe required, and that may be, and I don't know, we'll have to talk to a certified smart highwayman at that particular point. Are our highways, as a result of some of these loads, beginning to deteriorate, and thus the loads are actually bearing a greater weight in relationship to the cost of repairing, replacing, and maintaining the highways?
Well, Mr. Chair, not to add another tool to the toolbox.
I hear that. I'm going to take my hammer.
I have to say that there is nothing. The policy has always been the transportation policy, and the policy in the statutes, you could see it clearly, has always been to maintain revenue neutrality. Revenue neutrality is a policy with this. So if we were to increase everything else and then need to adjust the flat fees to catch up, then that's a different type of increase than the revenue neutrality adjustment type of increase.
And if I may, Mr. Chair,
yes,
does that bill, will in and I realize that we're close to the 2 o'clock hour, will that bill begin in transportation and then be referred to revenue, or does it begin in revenue and be referred to transportation before it goes to the floor?
Well, issue, the flat fees, is although there is a transportation component of it, there's a tax policy type of, so it could conceivably be a revenue type of bill, because there is nothing in the transportation policy that is changing in that regard. So it does not have to be initiated and started in policy, although it could very well be. I mean, it's a choice of the leadership of the assembly.
Sure, that all brings up some very interesting discussion, because what if in fact a bill is really needed on an annual basis or on a semi or biannual basis, and it appears that we're at that point now, and what if it's really needed but we're unable to pass it on the floors of the House and the Senate when it's a constitutional mandate that it has to be done in that fashion? That's why I'm wondering if a bill is really required, or if this isn't something that's administrative. But I'm certainly open to that discussion when it comes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me.
Thank you, Representative Butler. It does indicate in the material that Mazin has extracted in the Constitution, Article 9, Section 3A, and the boldface material says, the Legislative Assembly shall provide for a biennial review and, if necessary, adjustment of revenue sources to ensure fairness and proportionality. Now, notice it doesn't say that the Legislative Assembly shall, by law, adjust revenue sources to ensure fairness and proportionality. It says that the Assembly shall provide for. I assume that means that we could pass this law that made this an administrative responsibility for someone else to do, rather than having it done by the legislature directly.
The writer's back on that.
Well, I mean, it just says provide for. It doesn't say that we have to actually do it by law. So I suppose the legislature could write a statute that says that, that someone else is to make that adjustment, recognizing that the increases in taxes, for example, the overall system, fuel tax, for example, is going to only be changed on the basis of a statute which has to meet all the other constitutional requirements.
My concern, Mr. Chair, is that if they start doing this by administrative rule as opposed to statutorily, that it won't be long before portly males from Eastern Oregon will be charged more and they're traveling back and forth to Salem or something of that nature.
Spoken like an Eastern Oregon representative. Thank you, Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, with the discussion of Legislative Council in the past about this issue, not that this is the final say or anything on that, but the Legislative Council have always talked about the idea of the difficulty of the delegation by the Legislative Assembly of its prerogative to increase or change taxes to the executive branch. So it is something that the legislative branch needs to exercise every time it does. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's provided a two-year window with the highway cost allocation and the flat fee process in order to allow for the legislative branch to exercise that authority and that discretion, rather than delegate it to the executive branch.
Thank you. Is our 2 o'clock panel ready? No?
We're waiting for our guests.
We're waiting for our guests. I think what we're going to do is recess then for, don't wander off very far, because when they get here, we'll get right underway. So we'll recess the committee until we're ready to proceed with the cost, highway cost allocation report. We're waiting for the Transportation Committee also.
Where's Representative Reed?
Yeah, where's Representative Reed? He's a member
of both, huh?
And we're in recess. The Revenue Committee is back in session, and I understand that we're ready to hear from the ODOT part, a portion of the highway cost allocation study. And we're going to talk about flat fees first. So please come ahead, and we'll go ahead with that. We have a maximum of about 50 minutes to complete the entire report, so we're hoping that we can take you out of order and go ahead and do this.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Mike Marsh from the Department of Transportation. The testimony and the copies of the study itself are coming around. The flat fee study is something that we do every biennium. The flat fee payment option was created in lieu of the weight mile tax as a way to make tax reporting easier for motor carriers who use non-public or lesser traveled public roads, as a way to make the process easier for generally employees in the initial elements of the program back in the late 40s and early 50s were almost all small amount of trucks that were in the companies. ODOT has diligently conducted a review of flat fee rates each even-numbered year as required by ORS 825482 to determine whether or not flat fee payers are paying fees equal to if they had been under the weight mile tax program. We concluded that a few trucking industry groups were paying somewhat more and some were paying less than if they'd used the mileage tax. The summary is included on the actual study page 4 if the members want to go to that page. But our summary letter that is also out there indicates the amounts of up and down between the different groups that are included. The bottom line is, to address the problem, we took a look at the flat fee statute. And the flat fee statute is ORS 825480. And we were questioning what has been a long-standing practice of allowing motor carriers to switch between flat fees and mileage-based fees or weight mile taxes during the year. And we concluded that switching complicates the effort to ensure a revenue-neutral program, and that by having a switch from flat fee to weight mile tax more than once in a calendar year results in the system being used to, in essence, get a discount on the part of those companies that make those switches. And in talking with the Department of Justice to confirm the intent, as we read the statute, we found that the existing law only allows a carrier to make one payment switch each year, or one payment choice each year, for the calendar year, and does not allow for more than that one. So therefore, by making that change, which we implemented early this calendar year, it will reduce the amount of switching or toggling back and forth between the flat fee and the mileage-based fee. And the example of how that might be used is that during the winter months, a company could say that they're not going to be out much, so they're going to use the mileage-based fee when they're not traveling much, and in the summertime when they're are working a lot, they'd use the flat fee, and that way result in a discount. So, Mr. Chair, the bottom line is that we recommend that due to this change has been made, that provides the stability for the system, and rather than making other immediate changes which would make it difficult to determine exactly the outcome of what caused what, that we feel that it would be appropriate to not make a change in those the percentages and amounts that are charged to the various flat fee carriers, and to move ahead and do this for another 2 years, come back, do the study again, and determine if a change is needed at that time.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Marsh? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, I guess I'm not that familiar with the flat fee and the mileage-based fee. How often can a business change what their intent is with you?
Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, in the past, they were able to change it without really a constraint. and that meant that they could change it depending on the season and get the best thing for them in that particular season. In looking at the situation, how often it was being done, we took a closer look at the statute, and although it's been interpreted that way for 30 years, we felt that the statute really was being misinterpreted and went to the Department of Justice to say, can this occur within statute? And the answer from the Department of Justice was no. It's supposed to be one election a year. So by making that change, we feel like that will offset the percentage differences between a weight mile and flat fee.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And before we go on, I want to welcome our Representative Perry Beyer, who is the chair of the Transportation Committee. Thank you, Representative, for joining us this afternoon, for hearing this report. And there are other members of your committee on this one, are there not?
Yes, there are, although they're not here.
Well, hopefully they'll be back once they realize we're back in
They're not in either one.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Marsh.
Mr. Chair, again, with the flat fee, recommendation to you, to the legislature, mm-hmm. of what is to be done, and then the decision of the legislature of how to do is definitely what will be set in the intent of the legislature, because, as I said before, this has been under litigation many times, and there needs to be that a clear direction from you that you're whether you take that or not.
All right, so what form does that direction take?
Well,
do we need to write a bill? Do we need to pass a committee resolution? What do we need to do?
If you need to change it, then a bill needs to be done. If your intent is not to change it after because of the recommendation that you think that it is the right thing to do, then I guess it will be clarified by having your intent clear that it is.
So that's something that could happen through the committee discussion and the acceptance of the materials that we receive that recommend no changes. This material, of course, suggests that we don't have to do anything in connection with the flat fee issue at this point. And it looks as though we're ready to go along ahead with the cost allocation study. Is that right? Gentlemen. Quite a load you were carrying in here a minute ago.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's quite the report.
All riveting reading.
The riveting reading and all the papyrus files in the place are very pleased.
Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Batt, acting state economist. With the Department of Administrative Services. ORS 366.506 stipulates that once every 2 years, that the Oregon Department of Administrative Services shall conduct either a full highway cost allocation study or an examination of data collected since the previous study. The purpose of this is to determine the proportionate share that the users of each class of vehicles should pay for the cost of maintenance, operation, and improvement of the highways, roads, and streets in the state, and whether the users of each class are paying that share. To maintain the objectivity of the study, the Department of Administrative Services hired consultants, and that's also appointed a study review team to participate in the study. On January 31st, 2007, DAS notified your committees of the completion of 2007 highway cost allocation study, and our office acted as chair of the study review team. If there is any questions that I entertain, and our consultant will present the results of the study.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, chairs of House Revenue Committee and House Transportation Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Petowski, a senior economist with Equal Northwest and professor of economics at Portland State University. And please, I want to express my apologies for my lateness. Copiers blew up, and we were scrambling to copy the 96-page, both sides, report for the committees today. So please indulge with
Thank you very much for being here and recognize that we're well within the limits of legislative time.
Well, this committee tries to do better than that, but within the general rule, you're very much within time.
Yes, but Mr. Chair, I forgot that of all the legislative assemblies we've seen recently, this one is definitely geared to being on time and getting their work done. And do I need to suck up more? Do I need
to? No. Let's go ahead. Thanks.
Okay. The report that should hopefully be in front of you, and the slides show that I'll do today, is the report on the highway cost allocation study for Oregon. This is a report that's done every 2 years by constitutional amendment now. And let's just go into the report. The first study in Oregon was first among many states back in 1937. There's been 15 studies so far. Since 1999, as said, the state constitution has required the study every 2 years. And the essential question, and Dr. Beck related to this, are the shares of revenues paid by light and heavy vehicles fair and proportionate to their shares of costs? And that's the main focus of the study. And I think it should be kept in mind, too, this is not a study of highway funding adequacy. Whatever that funding level may be, the question in front of you is a fairness question. What is the shares that are allocated cost-wise to light vehicles versus heavy vehicles, and correspondingly, what proportion of revenues, what, in a sense, taxes do they pay along the way, and making sure that that ratios are in line and that people are paying essentially their fair share. The study is contracted out from the Department of Administrative Services, and they also oversee the study. The contractor for the study was Equal Northwest, with some other subcontractors involved. Also, we had two review individuals from universities, David Frokenbrock, engineer from University of Iowa, and Dr. Anthony Ruffalo from Portland State, an economist, providing peer review. There was also a project manager, Brian Hedman from Quantech, and then ODOT staff provided very strong assistance and data that was needed to complete the study. The study, by the way, it is overseen by Department of Administrative Services, and the whole purpose of this is to make sure that you have as unbiased and scientific study as possible. To that end, there's also a study review team that's made up of members that consult. And I should emphasize that they are advisory in capacity to the consulting team. The consulting team, final decisions rest with them. But you shouldn't exclude expertise that you have, given the individuals that are representative on the study review team. So they play a very, very important role in their advisory capacity to the consultants for the study. And my familiarity with the study is that I was state economist, and Dr. Beck has replaced me on that committee. So the question here is, do various classes of highway users pay user fees in proportion to the costs? So we have to do a few things. We've got to define who the user classes are, allocate costs to these user classes, attribute the revenues to them, and then finally calculate these equity ratios. And what you're essentially doing is looking for a ratio of one. You know, your proportion of what you're paying in should be proportion of the costs that you have incurred. And the user classes are generally defined as weight classes. And within those weight classes, there are various axles, numbers that trucks can have and so on in order to sort of make a fair comparison. Okay, so costs to allocate expenditures, therefore the upcoming biennium. So this is a prospective look. We're looking at the 07-09 biennium. So there's lots of forecasts involved in coming up with a study. We use information from basically 2005 and then through forecasts from both the Office of Economic Analysis and from ODOT's revenue forecasts, try to come up then with a perspective of what would be, for example, vehicle miles traveled in the next biennium. So there's also expenditures, plans that are going to be spent there. They then take these expenditures and allocate them out to the various groups. Here highlighted is that also involved are the expenditures of federal funds are included, and also local governments of state funds are also included. The reason for this is the question of fungibility. Federal funds could come in and possibly replace or shove state funding to some other project. Well, heavy vehicles and light vehicles, their responsibilities tend to change depending on the type of project. So if you excluded these, you actually may get a different mix of what might be occurring. So it was felt in this study, very similar to the 2003-2005 study, to include both the federal expenditures and also the local expenditures of state funds. And Chapter 2 of the report has more detail on this. Expenditures of bond finance projects are reduced by the amount of bond payments that were made within the biennium. Much discussion was involved by the SRT based on bond financing projects, both in the 2005-2007 study. Generally, ODOT had been on a pay-as-you-go process, but with the new ATIAs, Oregon Transportation Investment Acts coming on board, lots of new bonding was happening, much more borrowing, so it was felt to come up with a separate method to allocate that out. And so, essentially, we're allocating those expenditures out over the bienniums in terms of the servicing of those bonds, the repayment of that debt plus interest. And then our Chapter 3 has additional information on that issue. This is just a schematic of just saying that, you know, once we've had these bonds in place, they're going to be carried forward until the bonds are paid off in future studies. Bridge costs were a new problem really being faced for the first time to a huge extent. A little bit in 2005 study, more so in 2007 study. The bridge costs use an incremental approach. Concept here is that if you have a bridge, well, what would be the bridge just necessary for, say, light vehicles? And what would be the cost involved with that? And then if you had a slight, and then so everyone pays for that. And then if you had a little bit of a heavier vehicle, what would be the additional cost for that little heavier vehicle to be on that? And then all others above that would be paid. So you do this incremental aspect to come up with the final cost of the bridge, the expenditure on that bridge to allocate out to the different weight classes. So they use a study from OPEC, is a consulting engineering firm that specializes in bridges, the National Pavement Cost Model. Roger Mingo assisted in relating this national model, what it would mean for a data model in Oregon. And then the complete list of allocators are available to you in Chapter 3. Alternative fee-paying vehicles, referred to as subsidies. There's a certain class of vehicles, mostly public-owned and farm trucks, that generally have lower registration fees. They don't pay the weight mile tax, but they generally pay the fuel tax. Farm trucks, for example, pay a lower registration fee, the fuel tax, not the weight mile tax, but they only pay the fuel tax when they're on public roads. So coming up with this, if this is a subsidy, we have to figure out then if they are paying less than what they would have if they were straight with the vehicle miles traveled that most of the other weight classes are associated with, how do we spread out this subsidy? Costs is, in a sense, the responsibility of all other full fee-paying vehicle classes. Okay, and then just real quick, some of the other issue papers we had dealing with replacement bridges, expenditure revenues other than state fees, the bond revenues, innovative finance. There are 8 issue papers that the SRT study review team felt that the consultants should look at, theoretical issues, both for the study at this time and also for looking at future studies. For example, innovative finance, what possibly may be the future for cost allocation studies if we have toll rolls or if we have cars with transponders and we start to treat them like cell phones in terms of billing them. So these are the results of the 2007 study. This is broken down by the basic vehicles, which are considered your light vehicles. And in this study, this is the first time we've moved the weight class from 8,000 pounds up to 10,000 pounds. And it's still, the rationale here is that the type of vehicles and so on still seem to meet fairly well the idea of mostly passenger type cars. So here we come all the way down. I think the main point here is the bottom part, that equity ratio. You're looking at their share that they're paying, which is their annual cost responsibility, is essentially 64.4%. The user fees paid are 64.4%. Then the cost responsibility is around 63%. You're coming out with a ratio just a little below 1. So they're about 0.7% underpaying their fair share, is how that would be looked at. The heavy vehicles over 10,000 pounds.
Excuse me, just a moment. The statistician in me wants to ask what the error of measure is likely to be on that number. Is it more than 0.7%?
Mr. Chair, I would say probably yes. It probably would be more than that.
So these numbers really aren't significant then.
Well, in that I think if we're looking at in a statistical sense, a ballpark area, I think these are, you know, the best reasonable numbers we can come up with.
Right.
There are, of course, assumptions and so on. If we start changing those around, you can get even a wider dispersion. But I think, you know.
But this number is essentially 1.
In my mind, yes. I think that's definitely true.
Thank
essentially
you.
1.
Thank you.
There wouldn't be any difference between, if that was your question, that's right. There wouldn't be any difference really between this or 1.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Yes, we don't reject the null hypothesis. Heavy vehicles over 10,000. Once again, breaking these down, the payment by the full fee paying. And then you can see the payment by the user fees. Taking the user fees over the cost responsibility, we come up with a ratio that's just a little above 1. And so another way of looking at this would be their payment is 1.3% above what they should be paying. And once again, I think, Mr. Chair, the same comment that you had with the light vehicles would be true in this. There wouldn't be any significant difference between this and 1. Okay, now, the other aspects. So, given that the recommendation is that, well, let's do the heavy vehicle detail first. Equity ratios are ranging between 0.41 and 0.5. So, even though as a group above 10,000, within the heavy vehicles, there's a considerable amount of difference in their equity ratios. As it says, vehicles between 10,000 and 26,000 pounds are mostly overpaying. The vehicles between 26 and 78 are underpaying. Then as we jump up to the very, very large group of declared weights, the 78,000 and 80,000 group are overpaying by a little bit. And then most pay above 80,000 are underpaying. So we bring that just to your attention, that within this broader group, there is a bit of a difference in terms of their equity ratios. The recommendations, no changes to rates we feel are necessary for the light versus the heavy, a fairness and proportionality question, which is basically the main question that you have with this study. But the Chapter 7, the report describes revenue neutral changes two rate structures that would improve equity within heavy vehicles. So although we don't recommend any changes between light to heavy, within the heavy, we provide you with a set of rates that would reflect more equality, in a sense, of a equity ratios being one for the different heavyweight vehicle classes within that broad heavyweight vehicles.
Good, Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson.
So, Tom, if the way I'm following with what you're describing there and everything for the heavyweight vehicles, that's where you had mentioned earlier in your presentation about the axles fitting in.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, even within this, yeah, the axles are used to say, you know, if I've got a 85,000-pound truck, but it has six axles relative to four axles, the six axle shouldn't have as high of a rate on them because the weight is more distributed. So their damage on the road would be less.
Exactly.
Lesser axles.
Good follow-up.
Yes, please.
What do you do for consideration, then, of the trailers, for example, like your cement trucks that have the tag axles? And because I see a lot more of your trucks out there with semi-trucks that are having the tag axles.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, those, depending on the type of rig, they have to go by their declared weight. So if there's a trip, my understanding, and maybe Mazin may assist me on this, like a triple trailer, whatever their declared weight is, that's what it is while they're traveling with that. Now, if you've got a log truck that has these empty trailers and they stack them up on top of each other, it's acted as if they had the trailer trailing them and they had logs on it, and then they went into a garage and they took one off and then they went back out. So they could have multiple declare weights for the same vehicle, and so they would be treated separately.
Okay, thanks.
The flat fee rates, these are a special class for certain commodities that are hauled. Your log, your sand and gravel, and your wood chip trucks, they have a choice. They could either pay a flat monthly fee, or they can do the weight mile tax. So what the study did was just take a look at this and say, what is the current flat fee rate? What if we would just match that up to what the current vehicle miles per traveled are? And then if we were going to change the distribution within the heavy vehicles, what would be the rates that would be charged based on those recommendations? So we'll give those three to you. So the body of the report, this outlines it. The main body is chapters 1 through 7, and then we have appendices. Also provided for the Legislative Revenue Office is the model documentation and user guide, so that any changes that were made can be investigated very easily using this model. Some future issues. Besides the study, we have to look to the future of what changes we might have to do in this study and be prepared for those possible changes rather than being blindsided as they come forward. So just as an example, you know, external costs, social costs are excluded from the study. But it may be at some time we might want to start thinking about those being included as we possibly start moving to what we call more a marginal cost pricing situation. This would be pricing where cars, trucks are priced at the time of the day, where they're at, their actual weight at the time, and what road they're traveling upon. Because we're starting to see that more and more around the country, more type of transponders in cars, and as I described it earlier, treating cars almost like treating your cell phone in terms of being billed in terms of usage. So I think we just have to be prepared for those kind of changes. And then future opportunities, efficient pricing. As I said, each vehicle charged according to where and when it travels and what it actually weighs, rather than doing this sort of perspective and estimating and forecasting of what it might be. Certain aspects that would have to be looked at, and essentially the bottom part there saying the technology's rapidly upon us, where you know, GPS is becoming almost now commonplace in terms of cars. Continuous communication, current price levels, and hopefully also privacy protections would also be installed. So that concludes our report to you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Madison, did you have something you wanted to add?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add to tool in the toolbox. This is to the information that we would be, in Legislative Revenue Office, we would receive the technical model where we would be able to use this model that developed by the study, as was contracted by DAS, and we would be able to use that in case you would be looking for any changes in taxation, transportation taxation policy of any sort, in order to be able to always maintain this balance between the heavy and light. That's where we will be the receiver of this information and of this model and how we use it in order to maintain this constitutional requirement. And again, just to add to the final thought, as the Constitution requires the legislature to act on the issue of light and heavy, obviously you don't need to make that any changes, since those are, as you have noticed, practically one, which means they're in balance. However, the other recommendations that the consultants and DAS in that sense are giving you are things that you might ponder. This goes into the idea of the different weight classes within the trucking, and also into the Table B type of issues. Those are something that you might look at. You are not necessarily obligated constitutionally to do so. However, also I would like to bring your attention to their flat fee rates recommendation. It's a little different even than the flat fee study, because it adjusts to the flat fee, to the adjustments that they are recommending. So they have three levels of that recommendation itself. And to say that, you know, in the Legislative Revenue Office, we've worked with this process for a very long time. We feel very comfortable with what has been done. I have personally worked for it for a number of years, and we really appreciate all the work that has been done. And it might not look as difficult as the presentation that you have in front of you, but it is made to look good and easy on purpose. So, Mr. Chair, and on behalf of you and the committee, I think you probably have an excellent product in front of you that is phenomenal and qualitatively different than any other place in the nation, for that matter.
Well, thank you, and thank you very much for an excellent and, I think, useful presentation. Mm-hmm. For going to the extra effort to make sure that the members had copies, because I feel quite certain that all the members of this committee and all the members of the Transportation Committee will read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest this report. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Also, I'm glad that I don't have to read it twice, being a member of both
committees. Well, perhaps Representative Reed, your assignment will be to especially prepared for the exam.
I'll start with me.
Thank you very much. I have one question for Mazin. Do we have a vehicle available, pardon the pun, that wasn't intended, to make changes within the heavy vehicle category as suggested in the report?
If you need something of that sort for the discussion and change, Mr. Chair, I'm sure we could find a vehicle to do so.
And maybe I ought to ask the gentleman while they're here, we're not constitutionally required to make the changes you've suggested within the heavy vehicle category. Would you talk for just a minute about why it would be useful from an economist's point of view to either make or not make those changes as recommended in the report?
Mr. Chair, if
the degree that, you know, and your there's always two questions in economics. One's efficiency and one's equity. And this is definitely a report on the equity question. And so if that's your major concern on fairness, then making these changes would move each of the weight classes more towards their, in a sense, fair payment. What they, the costs that they supposedly are incurring are, in technical terms, we're allocating expenditures to certain classes based on what we think the cost is, relative to what they're paying in, would be more equalized. So in that criteria alone, on equity, I would say, yes, we have quite a wide variation in equity ratios among that heavy classes.
You consider that a significant difference among the various classes?
Yes, I think
from an economic point of view.
On an equity fairness question.
Great.
Yes. Yeah, and if we went to what we call marginal cost pricing and we could price them right where they are at the time of the day, a lot of these issues would go away.
Well, and if I understand what you're saying, that would involve that would result in very, very different pricing for
yes.
passenger vehicles as well, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
Much smaller vehicles.
Absolutely right, Mr. Chair.
The older person who drives the car to the grocery store and the church once a week would be charged a much lower rate or a much lower amount total than someone who's in the car every day all the time during rush hour and making utilization of roads during high demand times. That person would pay a lot more.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. It would be much more closely aligned to your usage of the road and the time of day of the road, too.
Thank you very much. Does that generate other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We appreciate very much your presentation today. Is there anything else that we need to discuss now, today? If you'll note, committee, that we're 4 minutes ahead of time, and with that, the House Revenue Committee is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.